Then before we start the talk, let's cultivate our motivation. And remember how interconnected we are with other living beings, how our happiness depends on them, how they've been kind to us, and remembering that they want to be happy and free of suffering as intensely as we do. And that there's no good reason why, there's no good reason to consider our own happiness more important than anybody else's. Then let's develop an attitude of love and compassion, an attitude that genuinely cherishes others, and that strives to fulfill our own spiritual potential to attain full awakening so we can be of the greatest benefit to others. And let's have that be our reason for sharing the evening together and sharing the Dharma together. So this point of there's no good reason to cherish ourselves more than others or to think our own happiness is more important than others. It sounds kind of nice when you think about it as a philosophy from the distance. But when you think about it as something to live day to day, what do you mean that my happiness is not more important than others? Come on. I'm me, and my happiness is the most important thing in the universe. You know, all this stuff about cherishing sentient beings, that's all well and good. We write it on Christmas cards. That's good. But you really expect me in my everyday life to cherish others more than myself or even equal to myself? Don't you know that I'm the most important one in the universe? This is what our mind says, isn't it? If we're honest. If we're not honest, we go, oh, la, 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 la. I love the world, you know. But if we're honest, whose happiness do we care about more than anybody else's? This one. Me. Yeah. So I always say that there's no good reason to care more about ourselves than others. There's lots of reasons. Yeah. Like, I'm me. Yeah, that's our usual reason. Why is my happiness more important than others? Because I'm me, and it's my happiness. Extremely logical, isn't it? Yeah, so there's lots of reasons, but not very many good reasons. And the thing is that when we, you know, are just focused so much on our own happiness and ignore the happiness and well-being of others, we create a world and an environment that is very unhappy around us. And if we live in the middle of a bunch of unhappy, discontent people, are we going to be happy? No, because when you live surrounded by unhappy people, they let you know they're unhappy. And then you aren't so happy. So His Holiness Dalai Lama always says, if you want to be selfish, be wisely selfish and take care of others. Because if we take care of others, we create a good feeling in the environment around us. You know, if you take care of your family members, take care of your colleagues, take care of your boss, take care of your employees, yeah, take care of the society around you. If we really focus on having that attitude of caring for all the living beings around us, instead of just for ourselves or just who's ever on our own side, then we create such a nice feeling and a wonderful feeling of well-being in those who are around us. And then we get to be with people who are happy. And that makes us a lot happier than being with people who are miserable, doesn't it? Yeah. So we sentient beings sometimes, we're really rather silly. Because when people do things we don't like, we get mad at them. We call them names. We throw things at them on a national level. We bomb them. And we expect through all of our aggressive behavior that then they're going to love us and do things our way. Right? Okay. When somebody treats you like that, do you love them and do things their way? Mm-mm. Yeah. So similar with other people. That kind of, you know, aggressive strategy doesn't work very well. Whether we're talking about a small group of friends or an off, you know, a workplace or even internationally. Yeah, that strategy doesn't work. And yet, throughout human history, we keep doing the same stupid thing again and again. Yeah, thinking that this time it's going to be different. And it isn't. Okay, so it's really important, you know, to see this and then to start changing our ways and changing our strategies. And I think especially changing our attitude, you know, where we really respect people and want to do what is, you know, beneficial for them. So this is a very practical thing. I'll just ramble for a minute about something I've been thinking about and something that happened today. So I've been reading, I usually read the New York Times, and they've had some articles about flying. You know, if anybody flies much, it's like not very comfortable nowadays, and you're jammed in, and it's, yeah. And there was even an article in the paper about the Orthodox Jews, who, an Orthodox Jewish man who doesn't want to sit next to a woman because, you know, in that culture, you're not supposed to touch other women who except your wives. So they would sit down on their seat, and if a woman was sitting next to them, ask them to move, you know. And so, you know, the New York Times always has a place where you can write comments, and sometimes I read those. Some people were just furious about it. You know, it's like, he can move if he wants, and who does he think he is, and lease his own airplane if he doesn't want to sit next to me, and buy two seats and, you know, keep one empty. And a few people said, well, you know, shouldn't we try and be calm and kind to other people? But a few people said that. Most people were angry. And then there was also an article recently about people just coming and sitting in somebody else's seat, even though, you know, people have paid for different, you know, if you pay for more legroom and then You come and somebody's sitting in your seat and says, hey, can you sit in my seat? Back there, it's the middle seat, you know, in the economy with no legroom. And how some people are just taking other people's seats and then making it very unpleasant if the person who actually reserved that seat wants it. Yeah. And so I was thinking, wow, you know, contention on an airplane just over a seat, and yet it's real, you know, because especially when flying is very uncomfortable nowadays, if, you know, you get your aisle seat, or, you know, if I get my aisle seat, yeah, or if you get a seat with extra leg room or whatever it is, then you want to hold on to it because it's pretty uncomfortable otherwise. And yet, you know, and yet there's all these people saying, you know, about, I'm not going to give up my seat. And then, yeah. And then there's also, you know, what people taught us, like just our parents taught us, be nice to the other person. Which it feels like not so many people want to be these days, at least from the comments in the newspaper. So I got on my flight this morning going to Chicago, and I got to my seat, and somebody was sitting in my seat. And it was a jam-packed flight. Every seat was filled. It was an aisle seat. I prefer aisles because I hate being scrunched in a middle seat between two big people because I'm small and then I can't move. And the lady, I looked at her and she had a child next to her, you know, and she said, can you sit in my seat? It's the middle seat up there. And I just went and sat in it. You know, it was no big deal. It was a short flight. But the steward, you know, the flight attendant comes over and said, thank you so much. That was very kind. I think she was relieved that I didn't, like, yell and scream or something. Yeah. But, every time when I can, I try and do that. You know, if somebody asked for my seat, because one time I didn't do it, and I felt so lousy afterward. It was like I could hear my teacher going there. I taught you to cherish other sentient beings. What are you doing? Have you ever had that happen where your teacher kind of magically appears right when you're in the middle of doing something you shouldn't be doing? Yeah. Yeah, but it is a nice thing to think about. You know, when you can just do small things that bring happiness to other people, it's good to do, and it doesn't take a whole lot of energy. You know, usually we think, oh, you know, if I really want to benefit people, I should be like the Dalai Lama and Mother Teresa, but I can't do that. Yeah, but they aren't in your family or at your workplace. And you are. Yeah. So it's a perfect opportunity to live the values that you cherish and get other people thinking about, you know, about kindness and about the benefits of cherishing others, because that's what's going to really create peace in our society. Okay, so I'm supposed to talk about Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions this evening, right? So I brought the book with. Unfortunately, I can't leave it here. I have to take it to Mexico, but you can get it through Amazon or local bookstores or wherever. So Wisdom did a beautiful job with it. Isn't it lovely? Yeah? Yeah, you can get it through Wisdom, right. And it has pictures in it. And it was really a work of love. And I learned so much doing this. You know, it was really fascinating because His Holiness wanted a book that talked about the different Buddhist traditions and how are they similar and how are they different. Yeah, because His Holiness thinks it's very important that Buddhists from multiple traditions know about each other and talk to each other so that we can act together on the world stage. And in previous times, transportation wasn't very good. Plus, people didn't know each other's languages. So each Buddhist tradition grew up in its own locale, not knowing much about others, except for certain tidbits that they heard here and there that got passed down through the centuries. So just stereotypical images of other traditions that may or may not be correct. Okay, so for example, you know, with our own Tibetan tradition, we know that many people call it Lamaism, or they used to, because when the Christian missionaries went to Tibet, they saw people paying such respect to their teachers that they thought they worshiped their teachers. So they called it Lamaism. Lama's teacher, and it, you know, Lamaism. It's a ridiculous name, isn't it? But that's what they called it. And then the Chinese looked at the Tibetans and the whole system of identifying incarnate lamas, and, you know, particularly the Dalai Lama. So they called all the incarnates God kings because they were gods, you know. His Holiness is the embodiment of Chenrezig. Chenrezig's a god, and he's also a king. So he's a god king, and then all these other recognized incarnates are called god kings, which is like, has nothing to do with it. Yeah. You know, other people think of the Tibetan tradition, and this is a big problem we have, actually. They think, oh, well, the Tibetans practice Tantra, so all these monks who are supposed to be celibate are going around having sex and drinking alcohol. And so they don't hold the Vinaya precepts properly. And even, you know, nowadays in Taiwan, there is a specific group that put out a whole half an hour long video, you know, warning people, if you have a wife, if you have a daughter, don't let her go to a Tibetan center, you know? Wow. Really? And totally misunderstanding what Tantra is, just thinking it's all about sex and alcohol, which is like not the case at all. Yeah. And putting out a video, and people watch this and they think, oh, Tibetans, better be careful. Yeah. And some of the monks, you know, their behavior corresponds to that, unfortunately. You know, the good monks, of course not. Most of the monks are good, but all you need is one to misbehave, and then, you know, everything blows up. And then also, you know, in the Chinese tradition, there was a tradition sometimes of high lamas going to live in Beijing, and they would do the pujas for the emperor, you know, and this has been going on for several hundred years, you know, into the Qing dynasty. And so people say, well, the Tibetans, you know, they do magic. That's what Tibetan Buddhism is, it's magic. You know, ring bells, play drums, you know, do exorcisms because they see the things, you know, when they do the little effigies and the little knots and, you know, take them out. And so Tibetan Buddhism is just magic. And I remember once, where was I? I was in Tennessee, and talking at a Dharma center, and somebody invited me to go into a classroom and give a talk. And I gave a talk, a time for questions and answers. One kid says, you know, our book about Buddhism says Tibetan Buddhists do magic. You know, tell me about it. What? You know, well, our textbook says that. I mean, these kind of misconceptions that are like way out. Okay. Now, of course, our tradition has its own misconceptions about the other traditions. First of all, we say, well, all those Theravadas, they're just selfish. Yeah, no compassion, selfish, want their own liberation. We're so magnanimous, we're working for the benefit of everybody, but please support our monasteries, you know. But these Theravadas are so selfish. And I remember one time I was invited to a place, and there was some kind of mix-up, because usually when you're invited to teach somewhere, the inviting people pay for your ticket. Well, I got there, and the center didn't want to pay for my air ticket, and it was an international ticket. Yeah. And they said, we never agreed to that. I said, And then, as it happened on the same teaching tour, I was teaching at a Theravada center. And after the talk, the Bhante, you know, who's from Sri Lanka, came over and he said, I heard that you were having difficulty with your air ticket here, and handed me an envelope with the money for the air ticket. Those selfish Hinayanas. Not like those magnanimous Mahayanas. Okay. And I also remember, this was like back in the 90s, maybe like 93, 94, His Holiness was talking. He was giving a bunch of series in Arizona. Anybody go to that by any chance?
In Tucson?
Yeah.
I went to the chapter 8.
Yeah, there was that one. And then there was another one like a few years before that. So it was the few years before that one. So what was my point? It was airfare, but it was... Oh, yes. Yeah, those selfish Hinayanas. So, they had organized an evening program where they asked different Buddhists to give talks. And one of the people in the evening program was, I think it was Sharon Salzberg. And so she was talking about the practice of the four immeasurables in the Pali tradition. And afterwards, one of my dear Dharma friends, I won't mention his name because he'd probably be embarrassed now, but who's a very prominent Dharma teacher, said, I had no idea that they even talked about love and compassion in Theravada Buddhism. Yeah? I mean, this is the level of ignorance that people have about different traditions. Yeah. So, and then of course, we think the Chinese, they're all Hoshang, right? You know, because we all hear, remember the story about the debate at Samye over meditation? Remember she hasn't told you that story? I'm sure he has. There was a big debate at the end of the 8th century between Hoshang, who was a Chinese abbot, and Kamala Shila. And it was over, you know, what is the proper type of meditation to do to, you know, gain realizations. And so Hoshang, the Chinese abbot, advocated some kind of blank-minded meditation, where all you do is clear all the conceptions out of your mind. You know, and he said, like black clouds, white clouds, it doesn't matter. You have to get rid of all the clouds. So good conception, bad conception, you have to get rid of all conception. And Kamala Shila is saying, yes, we have to get rid of the conceptions of inherent existence, but, you know, we need conceptions to understand the Dharma and to generate bodhicitta and to get a correct, the correct view of emptiness. Yeah, first we need to use the conceptual mind before you have direct realization. And so there was this big debate, and there was lots of theatrics about, I don't know, birds in the sky, and I can't remember all these tales, yeah. But anyway, Kamala Shila defeated Hoshang. Hoshang left, and that it was after that moment that that's when Tibet decided they were really going to follow the Indian tradition of Buddhism and not the Chinese tradition. Because you remember that Buddhism came to Tibet due to two princesses, one from Nepal who brought the Indian tradition, one from China who brought the Chinese tradition. So this was the point where they decided to go with the Indian tradition. But the Tibetans think everybody in China does blank-minded meditation. Yeah? And so they they refute it up, down, and across. But of course that's not true. Okay, so my point is that, you know, all the different Buddhist traditions have so many misconceptions about each other that really prevent us from respecting each other and working together and learning from each other. And so His Holiness very much wanted a book that showed, you know, the similarities, you know, why we're all Buddhists, you know, and how we all come together. And yet, His Holiness very strongly feels that we don't need to say that everything's the same in order to get along. So we have to all also acknowledge our differences. So this was the purpose behind writing the book. And so he sent me off to do the research on the Pali tradition. You know, we're calling it Pali tradition and Sanskrit tradition because it's a different vocabulary. Very often people use the vocabulary of Hinayana and Mahayana, which is a very difficult vocabulary to use because nobody self-identifies as a Hinayanist. Nobody says, I'm a Hinayanist and I'm proud of it. Why? Because Hinayana means lesser vehicle. It's a derogatory term that you didn't see very much when the Mahayana Sutras began to appear in India. The term Hinayana was not in them. This term came in the later as more Mahayana sutras started to appear, then that term arose, okay? And it means lesser vehicle, and it's derogatory, okay? And we still find it in use in Tibetan Buddhism. They talk about Mahayana and those selfish Hinayanas that you don't want to be like, okay? Don't really, it's true, isn't it? Yeah, it's true. Yeah, we hear about it all the time. So I did want to use that term, you know, Mahayana and Hinayana. And His Holiness never uses the term Hinayana anymore. Never. He calls it the fundamental vehicle. Yeah? And that's actually, I think, a very good term because we always hear that to practice Mahayana, you have to do it on the foundation of the fundamental vehicle. And this is a big misunderstanding in American Buddhism. People in American Buddhism, yeah, they talk about Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism. Those are the three, isn't it? Yeah? You pick up a Buddhist magazine, Vipassana, Zen, Tibetan. Those are the three Buddhist traditions. It's completely off base, yeah? I'll talk about that in a minute, but let me get back to the preceding point. So fundamental vehicle, you know, is it includes, we decided to call it the Pali tradition because most of those scriptures were in Pali, okay? What is very interesting is in the scriptures that are Pali that the modern day Theravada follow, there is also a Bodhisattva path. Isn't that interesting? Right there in the Pali Sutras, those Hinayanas have a Bodhisattva path. Yeah, of course the Mahayanas don't talk about that. Okay, but so it's very interesting because you have Dhamma, what was his name? Dhamma, why can't I remember his name now? Anyway, Dhamma somebody, if I pull out my glasses, I'm sure I can find it. He was 6th century Indian, and he wrote a whole treatise about the in Pali about the Bodhisattva path, including 10 paramis. Yeah, that's the Pali term for paramita, or perfection, what we call perfections. So there's a list of 10 paramis. In the Mahayana, in the Sanskrit text, there's also 10 paramitas that are subsumed into 6. So the two lists of 10 are not exactly the same. They have a lot of overlap in them. But even the ones that are unique in each tradition, the same meaning is found in the other tradition as something to be practiced. Yeah, and Bhikkhu Bodhi even told me that in, let me see if I can find his exact name, Dhammapala, protector of the Dharma is the meaning of his name. So he, Bhikkhu Bodhi told me that when Dhammapala wrote his treatise on the paramis, that a section of it is almost verbatim from the Bodhisattva Bhumi by Maitreya or Asanga, different people attribute that, you know, which is a Sanskrit text, which is quite interesting, isn't it? Just a little bit of plagiarism there. But it showed that there was, you know, there's crossover, yeah, and yeah, and then there's also another text in Pali, in the Buddhavamsa, the chronicles of previous Buddhas, and it tells the story of how Shakyamuni Buddha generated bodhicitta, and it's so moving. It's just, it's incredibly moving. In fact, let me read that to you from this book, okay? I put it in here because so often when I bow to the Buddha, I think about this story. I just found it so moving. Let me find it here. That comes under. Okay, let me just read you this section, okay? So it starts out, this is our voice. So the pure intention of a bodhisattva, that's the Pali term for bodhisattva, bodhisattva, is illustrated in the story of the Buddha's previous life as King Sivi, who desired to give his eyes to someone in need. To test him, Sakka, the lord of the devas, appeared as a decrepit, blind old man who asked the king for his eyes. With great joy, King Sivi immediately had the doctor remove his eyes to give to the old man. After doing this, he said, "While I was desiring to give, while I was giving, and after the gift had been given by me, There was no contradictory state of mind. It was for the sake of awakening itself. Omniscience was dear to me. Therefore, I gave the eyes. This is in a Pali scripture. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Doesn't it sound familiar? The Buddhavamsa relates the inspiring story when Gautama Buddha generated bodhicitta in his previous life. Born into a wealthy family, the Brahmin Sumedha lived a life of luxury. When his parents died, however, he realized the impermanence of mundane happiness and resolved to seek liberation and became a matted hair ascetic. Yeah, what would his parents say? Okay, one day he learned that the Buddha Dipankara and his disciples were to visit the city near his hermitage. Descending from his hermitage, he began to clear the path for them, but was unable to finish before they arrived. As the Buddha Dipankara approached, Sumedha, elated to see him, prostrated and lay down in the mud. Sumedha relates this moving event, and this is from the Buddhavamsa. Loosening my hair, spreading my bark garments and piece of hide there in the mire, I laid down prone. Let the Buddha tread on me with his disciples. Do not let him tread in the mire. It will be for my welfare. Okay, then our voice again. When he initially invited the Buddha and his disciples to use him as a bridge across the mud, Sumedha was focused on his own welfare. He knew that if he wished, he could eradicate defilements and become an arhat that very day by listening to a discourse by Buddha Dipankara. Questioning his self-centered intention, he made an unshakable resolve to become a Buddha and to lead all other beings out of samsara. And now the quote from the Buddhavamsa. What is the use, while I remain ignorant, of realizing Dhamma here? Having reached omniscience, I will become a Buddha in this world with its devas. What is the use of my crossing over alone, being a person aware of my strength? Having reached omniscience, I will cause the world, together with its devas, to cross over. By my merit towards the supreme among humans, I will reach omniscience. I will cause many beings to cross over, cutting through the stream of samsara, shattering the three renewed existences, embarking on the ship of Dhamma. I will cause the world with its devas to cross over. And that's what he thought, lying with his face in the mud, so that the Buddha could and his disciples could walk on top of him. Isn't that beautiful? I find that so moving. Yeah, and so at that point, Dipankara predicted Sumedha's full awakening, and, you know, in future eons, he became the Buddha, you know, Gautama Buddha. Okay, so, you know, in the process of brewing this, preparing this book, I came across things like that. Like, oh, they have the Bodhisattva path. You know, because I never heard any of my teachers say that. Yeah. And they have the four immeasurables. I mean, a whole in Buddhaghosa, who's one of their chief commentators, in his, classic commentary, the Visuddhimagga, the Path of Purification, huge chapter on love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Yeah? And, of course, within that, when he talks about generating love, he talks about how to overcome anger. Yeah, and his treatise was taken from some of the ancient treatises in Sinhala and Ceylon. And many of the methods he talks about for overcoming anger sound like Shantideva in chapter 6 of Shantideva. So I found all sorts of interesting things like this. Okay? So anyway, the point before this that I never finished, because I keep getting distracted, going down tangents, is we decide to call it Sanskrit and Pali tradition after the language. So Pali tradition doesn't just mean the Theravada, modern-day Theravada, and it certainly doesn't mean Hinayana. Okay? Because what you find in the Pali tradition is the Shravakayana, which is the hearer vehicle, and you also find a bodhisattva vehicle. It's not as elaborately explained as in our tradition, but it's there. Within the Sanskrit tradition, you find lots of Mahayana texts, lots about the bodhisattva vehicle, but you also find things about the Shravaka vehicle, because somebody who becomes a Buddha has to know how to lead people with the Shravaka or hearer disposition to the Shravaka, you know, awakening. So in Ornament of Clear Realizations, you know, the Maitreya's text that they studied so much in the monasteries in South India, you know, there's a lot in there about the path to becoming an arhat. So what you have is, you know, according to language, you know, it's different than dividing Buddhism into Hinayana and Mahayana. Okay. Aside from the fact that Hinayana is a horrible term that all of our Theravada friends feel very insulted when somebody uses it. And so His Holiness, you know, when he gives public talks, you know, there's lots of people from different Buddhist traditions who go there. And His Holiness, of course, doesn't want to offend anybody. So he says fundamental vehicle. And then also that terminology, like I said, it really emphasizes to people practicing the bodhisattva path that you have to practice that on the basis of the Four Noble Truths and on the basis of renouncing samsara, yeah, and on the basis of, you know, the higher trainings of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Yeah, that we can't skip over the foundation teachings and just go to the bodhisattva vehicle or go even to tantra right away. We have to, you know, set a very firm foundation on the common teachings that are shared by all the traditions. Yeah, and that's quite important, I think, nowadays, because you have many people coming fresh into Buddhism. You know, what's advertised in the Dharma Center is Tantra. And, you know, you haven't even heard refuge, and, you know, you're going in for a tantric initiation. You haven't looked at your mind. You don't have any idea about who you are right now, and already you're imagining yourself as somebody else. Okay? You know, so this whole thing that, you know, make a good foundation is really important. Then I want to come back to this other point of how in America they talk about Vipassana, Zen, and Tibetan Buddhism as the three traditions. Okay, and you see it in Buddhist magazines. Some years ago, there was a teachers' conference at Garrison Institute, and this is what people were talking to, these three traditions. And I'm going, you know, it's like these people don't understand Buddhism. These are Buddhist teachers, and they don't understand that these are not the, you know, the major Buddhist traditions. Anyway, Rinpoche got up towards the end of the conference, and he explained it to them. Yeah. Of course, after that, I still see the same thing in the Buddhist magazines, you know, because people have a hard time learning things new. But he definitely corrected it, yeah, which was really good. Okay? So, and the reason that that way of doing it is incorrect is, first of all, Vipassana is a meditation technique. It's not a Buddhist tradition. It's a meditation technique. And all Buddhist traditions have Vipassana meditation. So to call it the Vipassana tradition doesn't make any sense, because in Tibetan, the Tibetan term for Vipassana is Laktong. If you know, when you, lots of you have J. Rinpoche's great exposition on, you know, the Lamrim Chenmo, yeah? Well, the third volume is called Laktong Chenmo, the great Vipassana, okay? So calling, you know, kind of watching your breath and watching the sensations in, of your body, which is one way of doing Vipassana, our, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, our way of doing Vipassana is different, but, you know, it's a meditation technique, it's not a tradition. Okay, so first of all, that thing, Vipassana as a tradition, is incorrect. Then, saying Zen, okay, Zen is a tradition, but people in America were thinking that Zen meant all of Mahayana. And they were thinking that that did not include Tibetan Buddhism, because remember, Tibetan Buddhism is your third tradition. Yeah, because you have Vipassana and Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. So they're thinking of Tibetan Buddhism. It has nothing to do with the fundamental vehicle, has no Vipassana, has no general Mahayana, and that Zen was the only kind of Mahayana tradition there is. Which, again, wrong. Okay. In China itself, you know, there's many Mahayana traditions. Historically, you know, the ones that are still extant, of course, you have Chan, which is China. The term Chan in Chinese is what the Japanese translate as Zen, which is in Sanskrit dhyana, like the five dhyana Buddhas. That same term. That's the term for Zen. Okay. Then there's Pure Land Buddhism, chanting the name of Amitabha or Kuan Yin with a motivation to be born in Sukhavati, you know, which, how many of our prayers do we dedicate to be born in the land of great bliss, in Amitabha's pure land? Yeah, lots of our prayers. You know, it's in the Sixth Session Guru Yoga dedication verses, you know, for example. Okay, and then there's the Tentai, which is another Mahayana tradition, the Huayin, yeah, another Mahayana tradition. So there's, and Tibetan Buddhism actually is a Mahayana tradition. Okay? And Mahayana is based on the fundamental vehicle. It's not separate from it. And then they were thinking Tibetan Buddhism was only Vajrayana. They were using Vajrayana and Tibetan Buddhism as synonyms. Again, completely wrong. Because, as we all know, you know, Vajrayana is one type of Mahayana tradition, along with Zen and Pure Land and Huayin and Tendai and the others, you know. And Tibetan Buddhism contains all the teachings of the fundamental vehicle, the general Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. Okay? And within that, you know, people practice all different sorts of things. So, yeah, I was just so appreciative when Rinpoche at the end of the conference explained this to people. So this is also another misconception, you know, I tried to clear up in here. okay? But there, when you really get into to looking at the different traditions, you just find so much beautiful stuff. And even reading the Pali Canon, you know, most of which has been translated into English. And you read the stories in the Pali Canon, and you find stories and analogies and so on that we have in the Lam Rim. You know, when you study Precious Human Rebirth, there's the story about the turtle putting his head through the yolk. Remember that story? You know, that's how rare it is to have a precious human rebirth, this turtle at the bottom of the ocean who comes up once every 100 years. That story is also in the Pali Canon. Isn't that interesting? What else? Oh, the story about the leper, you know? The leper who, you know, this is used in the middle scope about the disadvantages of samsara and how satisfying our craving just, you know, actually causes more pain. You know, we often hear the thing of the analogy Jay Rinpoche uses, like you drinking salt water. Yeah, you're thirsty, you drink salt water, it makes you more thirsty. Okay, well, another analogy that you also find in our tradition is like a leper who, what is it? Yeah, a leper who scratches, yeah, their wounds like you're dissatisfied in samsara, so you scratch and you try and get your object of attachment. But when the leper scratches the wounds, it just makes them worse. Yeah. So you find all sorts of things. You know the verse that we do when we take the Mahayana precepts? Yeah? You take the Mahayana precepts? Yeah? That verse is almost exactly identical to the verse in the Pali tradition that they say when they take the 8 one-day precepts, which is a pratimoksha ordination. Yeah? There's the part about, you know, for the benefit of others, for the sake of others. That part's not there. But, you know, the heavenly steed and the great elephant, and, you know, the mind properly liberated, the wisdom properly liberated, all, you know, all of that is in the, you know, what our Theravada friends say as well. Okay. How many of you are familiar with the four great vows of the Chan tradition? Are you familiar with those? I'll read those to you. When I was working on the book, His Holiness asked, there were two geshis who helped me at different points in time to go through the manuscript and make sure things were correct. So one of the geshis, when he was checking this and he read about the four great vows in the Chan or Zen tradition, again, he was so, you know, he didn't know anything about Chinese Buddhism, you know, because, you know, all you hear is that they're all like Hoshang, practicing blank-minded meditation, which is the cause to be reborn as an animal. you know, and he read this. Okay, here are the four great vows in the Chan tradition. Sentient beings are countless. I vow to free them. Defilements are endless. I vow to eradicate them. Dharma doors or Dharma teachings are limitless. I vow to cultivate them. The Buddha's way is supreme. I vow to attain it. Nice, huh? Yeah? Totally exactly what we've learned in 4 short lines. Yeah? Quite beautiful. What else can I tell you about this? Oh, one thing that I found was very interesting is the the notion of selflessness and emptiness. Yeah. In the Pali scriptures, they don't use the term emptiness very much. Yeah. They don't translate the Sanskrit term as selflessness. They translate it as no self or not self. Okay. And several of the passages that I read in the translated from the Pali scriptures, I could kind of hear Nagarjuna in them. Yeah. Let me find a couple of those for you. Okay. Here's a quote from Vasudhimagga Buddha Ghosa. There is no doer of a deed or one who reaps the deed's results. Phenomena alone flow on. No other view than this is right. And so, vikama and result thus causally maintain their round, as seed and tree succeed in turn. No first beginning can be shown. A monastic disciple of the Buddha with direct knowledge of this fact can penetrate this deep and subtle empty conditionality. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah, there's no doer of a deed or one who reaps the deed's result. Okay. Now, what's tricky is we hear the words, but we're not always sure of exactly how these words are interpreted. Yeah, because as we know from studying tenets, some people may say there's no doer of a deed or one who reaps the deed's result and think there's no substantially existent person who's the doer of the deed or the reaper of the results. Other people may say there's no inherently existent person. Yeah. But still, the fact that here's this verse and you can read it in more than one way according to your own philosophical stance is quite something. There's, if you studied how one of the refutations, well, actually, the one in Nagarjuna's Mula, treatise on the Middle Way, yeah? His first verse, it's not born, nothing is born from self, from others, from both, from causelessly. Yeah, remember that verse? Have you studied that at all? It's the first verse in the Madhyamika Karika Svayanagarjuna. The same idea is in the Pali Canon. Yeah? There's a whole passage in here. I won't read it to you. But quotes the exact same idea in the Pali Canon. Okay, here's something from the Sutta Pitata, Sutta Nipata, this is another Pali scripture. He who does not find core or substance in any of the realms of being, like flowers which are vainly sought in fig trees that bear none, such a monastic gives up the here and the beyond, meaning future lives, just as a serpent sheds its worn-out skin. Okay? Not finding core or substance in any of the realms of being. Sounds like not finding inherent existence anywhere in samsara. Yeah? Everything's empty even here in existence. Okay, here's another one from the Pali. Bhikkhus, suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A person with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and insubstantial. For what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, bhikkhus, whatever kind of form there is, whether it past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, a bhikkhu inspects it, ponders it, and carefully investigates it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and unsubstantial. Okay? That's like meditating. In our tradition, we would call it the selflessness of phenomena, in particular the body. Examining what is the body. We think there's a real, truly existent body here, but when you examine it and dissect it mentally, you see that within this thing there is no body. It is void, hollow, and insubstantial. Yeah. And that whole quotation is also in the Pali scripture. And I got to tell you this one. Let me see if I put that quote in here. I should have if I didn't. It's a very famous one. You know, when we study the different ways of analyzing, are things one or different? You know, is the person one with the body, you know, different from that? That whole way of analysis, that's also in the Pali scriptures. That interesting? Okay, here it is. This is a very famous quotation that our teachers quote a lot. It's from the Pali scriptures, okay? It says, why now do you assume a being? I got to tell you the secret. Yeah. This was spoken by a nun. Yeah. The Tibetan lamas never say that. I don't think they know, because they just say, Hinayana Sutra says. But this was spoken by Vikuni Vajira. What do you think of that? Okay, very famous quotation. So she was meditating. Mara came along and started bugging her. You know, Mara is the embodiment of, you know, all of our defilements and all of our hindrances, and comes along and starts, you know, trying to distract her and, you know, everything like that. So she turns around and says to Mara, why now do you assume a being? Mara, is that your speculative view? This is a heap of sheer formations. Here, no being is found. Just as with an assembly of parts, the word chariot is used. So when the aggregates exist, there is the convention of being. Okay, even the example of the chariot. Yeah? So my theory is that, you know, in the early days of Buddhism in India, you had supposedly 18 schools, you know, and they all had Tripitakas, you know, with the Vinaya basket, Sutra basket, Abhidharma basket. But, you know, different sutras made it to different places. And then, of course, things were passed down orally, so not everything was exactly the same. And then, you know, in each area and with these different schools, then people started writing commentaries and interpreting them and explaining them. And so you have different ways of interpreting different passages. Yeah. So I think that, you know, historically, a lot of Tibetan Buddhism in terms of the tenon systems, because we always study the Vibhasakas and Sautantrikas, that came from the Sarvastivada ancient school, the ancient school of the Sarvastivadas. And they were very substantialist, you know. They thought that, yeah, that, you know, past, present, and future objects all substantially existed. You know, it was like they were really concrete. And I think that Nagarjuna was familiar with many of their scriptures and heard them explaining their scriptures in this very concrete or absolutist view. And I think a lot of his teachings were refuting the Sarvastivadas and their interpretation. Yeah. And, you know, so that's, especially in the Karikas, I think that's what he was really doing. And then what happened historically, you know, by the time Buddhism got to Tibet, you know, they just, you know, all of the 18 schools, which all had different views, all got put under the category of Vibhasika. And, you know, with not a little bit of differentiation between them, but not very much. So I think that the Tibetans never really knew what the, you know, what was going on in Sri Lanka. Yeah. I'm not saying that what was going on in Sri Lanka, the philosophy is the same as the Middle Way school. I'm not saying that. Okay? But what I am saying is there's a lot in the Pali Suttas that you could read in many different ways. And, you know, it could have been in Sri Lanka that there were people who read the scriptures in a very different way. Also, you may not know this, but there were three big monasteries or three big monastic traditions in Sri Lanka in ancient times. There was the Mahavihara, the Abhayagiri, and the Jetavana. Yeah, the Mahavihara was eventually the one, one king backed it in the 12th century and kind of suppressed the Jetavana and the Abhayagiri and called what they were doing false doctrine. And those two other schools had a lot of Mahayana sutras and a lot of Mahayana influence. And there was even some tantric influence in Ceylon before it got suppressed. Very interesting, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah? When, you know, in working on this book, His Holiness told me to go to Thailand. So I went to spend a couple of weeks in one Thai monastery. It was a very interesting situation because they don't have fully ordained nuns there. And, you know, the Tibetans don't have fully ordained nuns either. They have novices. But I took my full ordination in the Chinese tradition, yeah. So I went there, and of course, I mean, they don't know what in the world to do with me. Yeah, where do you put a big uni, a big shuni? We don't have any, you know. You can't put her with the monks. You know, you can't put her with the lay people. But they actually handled it twice quite gracefully, and I just went along with whatever they wanted. I wasn't going to make a big stink about anything. But very interesting staying there, you know, and being part of their community and seeing how, you know, Buddhism is practiced in that tradition. And, you know, they still go on Pindapat, you know, with their alms bowl. Yeah. Sometimes they drive to the village and then get out of the car with their alms bowl. Yeah. Some places still walk, you know, the monks walk to the village. But, you know, where I was staying, they were quite far away, so they would get in a van and drive to, to the homes and then do their pindapat and then drive back. Okay. So it was really, really kind of interesting. But, you know, I asked this kind of question to His Holiness. I said, you know, how come, you know, here the Thais do like that. How come the Tibetans don't do like that? And he said, well, first of all, you know, in old Tibet before 59, a quarter of the male population was monks. If they all went into the city with their bowls, my goodness, it just would be too hard for the lay people to fill all those bowls because there would be thousands of monks coming into Lhasa every day collecting alms, and the, you know, it would just be too hard on the lay people to do it. Also, the monasteries were far, you know, they were you know, Sarah and Drepung were comparatively close to Lhasa. Gandan is like an hour and a half by car. They didn't have cars then. But even walking from Sarah and Drepung, it would be a long walk. And in the snow, you know, that wouldn't work too well. Okay. So he said, you know, therefore, in Tibet, you know, just as a practical issue, then the Tibetan monastery started cooking their own food rather than going on Pindapat. In China, the Chinese monasteries also stopped going on Pindapat. First of all, because in Chinese culture, it was very rude to go, they called them beggars, you know. They weren't beggars. The Sangha was never begging. You know, they didn't ask. They were on alms round. They collected alms, but they didn't beg. But they looked like beggars going through the villages with their bowls. And the Chinese criticized, because in Chinese culture, that's like horrible to do. Okay? So that was one reason why the Chinese didn't, you know, do Pindapat. Another one is to do Pindapat, you have to be in the village, you know, you can't walk so far. But if you're in a village or your city, then you get involved in all the emperor's politics and all the court politics. And so the people who practice Chan, they wanted just to meditate. Because remember, Chan means dhyana, which means, you know, meditative stability. So they wanted to get out of the city into the countryside where they could meditate, but then they couldn't go on Pindapat because there's no people out there. So then they started growing their own food, and that's where you got chop wood, carry water. Yeah. Okay? So anyway, I'm telling you little bits from here and there, but my main thing is that it's just incredibly interesting to study the different traditions, to see what they have in common, to see their differences, and to really go into the philosophy behind it, you know, and see lots of our Lam Rim teachings there in the other traditions, you know, maybe said in different words or whatever, but you can read it, and then it stimulates your own practice, it helps your own practice to hear different examples or hear the same teaching in different words. Yeah. So what I'd like to do now is open it to you so you could ask questions and make comments.
I'm wondering, I'm appreciating the use of this word fundamental in place of a more insulting word, but it's got a lot of baggage in the West, in Christianity and Judaism, Islam. That word has a lot of negative baggage.
But fundamentalist is different than fundamental, where fundamental means basic or foundation. Yeah? So you're right. Fundamentalist definitely has a lot of baggage. But I never thought of fundamentalist and fundamental. That's interesting. I never put that together like that, but yeah.
Well, when you first said it, it felt really positive. Mm-hmm. You know, to get out of this hole of these disparaging words. But then this sort of curtain of darkness came down.
Yeah, well, lift it back up again. Okay. Yeah, it means fundamental, the basic vehicle, the foundation vehicle. Yeah, that's the meaning. Yeah. Okay, other comments, questions? I think, yeah.
I had seen you talk about sort of the genesis of this book on a little video online.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, once upon a time, it was sometime in the 90s, early 90s or mid 90s or something, I I finally succeeded in, I had told Tenzin Geshe-la, who used to be His Holiness's secretary, that I wanted to do this, but it took a couple of years to get an appointment with His Holiness. But I requested His Holiness, please, to write a short text that Tibetan Geshe's could use to teach the Lamrim, especially for people who did not grow up as Buddhists, like all of us. Because I said the regular Lamrim, the way it begins, it assumes you're already a Buddhist. It assumes you believe in reincarnation and that you know what the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha are. And this doesn't work very well for people in our culture, and especially the first meditation being the guru is Buddha, you know, which is for people actually who are going to take tantric initiation. It's not a teaching for baby beginners. And Western people misunderstand it, and it creates a lot of mess. And so I thought, you know, wow, if His Holiness could write a text, just a simple text with the order of the subjects, you know, in some kind of verse form that the Geshe's could use so to fill in the whole background for all of us in the West. So His Holiness listened and nodded his head, and he said, but first we need to do the long version. And he had the private office give me the transcript of a teaching he gave on the Lamrim. I'm forgetting now which Lamrim text it was. I can't remember. Might have been the Sacred Words of Manjushri. Yeah, it might have been that one. Anyway, so he gave me that, and he said, use this as a foundation, and, you know, fill it out and add stuff. So I would go away, and then I'd come back, and, you know, every few years, and have a series of interviews with him. And he would, you know, answer questions and fill in the things. And then I took teachings that I had heard him give and texts, you know, that he had taught and so on, and put this all in. But because it took so long, you know, from one set of interviews to another, it took many years, you know, every time I came back, the book had gotten bigger. And then at one point, His Holiness said, I want it to be about all the Buddhist traditions, to have information about all the Buddhist traditions. You know, otherwise it's just going to be like all the other Lamrim books. So go out and learn about the other traditions. So I went and did that, but I didn't completely understand exactly how His Holiness wanted it. And then, you know, so I put that in. And so pretty soon the manuscript is over 2,000 8.5 by 11 font 11 pages. and then in the interviews in 2012, then it finally became clear that he did want one volume that was about the different Buddhist traditions. So then I went through those 2,000 pages and extracted a little, you know, the bits that I considered the highlights, left a lot out, and, you know, and then this book came out. It came back out in November. And then I just signed a contract with Wisdom to do the long book. Yeah. And in writing the long book, I had asked several, you know, people who were old Dharma students, like, what points are very confusing for you that you really need, you know, where you feel the culture gets in the way of understanding, and where you really need a very clean, clear explanation. And so I collected some of those topics, and those were a lot of the things that I asked His Holiness about in the interviews. You know, and it's so interesting because His Holiness has, every teacher has their own way of teaching and of guiding students and emphasizing different points. And His Holiness is so practical, and he's always emphasizing reasoning, You know, if you go to his teaching, always talk about reasoning and things have got to make sense. So, and I find that so refreshing, you know, personally speaking. I'm not one of these kind of, you know, well, Buddha said it, so believe it persons. I can't do that. So I really like that. So sometimes I would ask him questions, yeah. Like, do you know the story about the dog's tooth? Yeah, you know, I'll tell it to you. So there was an old woman, her son was going off on pilgrimage, I forget, to Bodh Gaya or Lhasa or somewhere. And she asked her son, please bring me back a relic of the Buddha that I can put on my altar and, you know, use to inspire me. So the son went and did his pilgrimage. He came back. He's almost home, and then he realizes, oh, no, I forgot to bring my mother a relic of the Buddha. And then he looks around, and there is a dead dog who, you know, who's the vultures had eaten the flesh off the dog, and it was just the skeleton. So he took a tooth from the dog. Yeah, and when he got home, he said, Mom, here's the relic of the Buddha's tooth. Okay, it's the dog's tooth. So Mom believes her son, you know, takes the dog's tooth, thinks of it. You know, she has so much devotion, so much faith in the Buddha, that she prays to this dog's tooth, and due to her devotion and faith, relics start appearing from the dog's tooth. You know, these little relics and things like that. So, you know, Tibetan lamas love that story. Yeah. I asked His Holiness, I said... you know? I said, do I really, you know, is that something I should believe? And he said, rubbish. But His Holiness is so skillful, because at one of the recent Lam Rim teachings, I heard him tell that story, because I think in the Tibetan culture, they love it so much, so His Holiness told it. But when he was talking to me, I think his own personal view was, you know. That great. So, other questions or comments? Yeah.
You said that His Holiness was one of the reasons for this book was to see where the common ground is, so that we can, as Buddhists, have more of a presence on the global stage.
Mm-hmm.
What are the Pali people as interested in this as? Sanskrit tradition.
Yeah.
And in what way is he hoping that this will,
okay.
That specific part of it will be.
Okay. I think, if I could just rewrite the question a little bit, is anybody else besides His Holiness interested in this? Yeah. We're in the process of finding out. His Holiness was very specific. He wants the book... he's having it translated into Tibetan because he wants the monks to know about this and the nuns to know about this. Yeah, that was a major thing, you know. And I kind of reminded him of it because I thought, you know, this is important stuff. And then he wants it translated into Sri Lankan and Burmese and Thai and Laotian, Cambodian. And we're trying to find translators and publishers. It's not so easy, you know, to find good translators who can do a Dharma book, to find publishing houses in these countries. Or maybe what we'll have to do is, because sometimes in Southeast Asia, they translate it and then publish it for free distribution. So we might have to do that, find funding to do that. But I'm really hoping that people will read it and that it will help to clear away these misconceptions. And also on the behalf, you know, of the Tibetans too. Yeah. It's quite interesting, you know. I mean, human beings are human beings. Any Buddhist from whatever tradition always thinks their tradition is the most complete representation of the Buddha's word. Yeah? Oh, another thing I asked him about, you know, when you take different tantric initiations, you always hear, oh, you know, Yamantaka is the supreme of all tantras because of da da da. And then Guru Samaja is the supreme of all tantras, incomparable to all the other. And then Vajrayogini is the supreme of all tantras. You know, and they all have this stuff about, you know, they are the one big supreme one, you know. And so I asked His Holiness about it, and he said, yeah, they all do that. That's propaganda for their own tantra. Yeah? So for me, anyway, his approach is like so down to earth, you know? He doesn't require you to believe things that sound fanciful, and he's always emphasizing reasoning. But, you know, when you see His Holiness in different circumstances, he definitely has that mystical, magical part of himself too. Yeah, and he'll teach that. But he's able to connect the two very, very well. Yeah. Okay, so let's have a little silent meditation now. And then we'll dedicate. Okay, so think about what you heard tonight so that you can take some of it home with you and use it in your practice. Let's rejoice that we created so much merit this evening, thinking about something new, exploring the different traditions, generating respect for all of them because they came from the same skillful teacher of the Buddha. Let's rejoice at all that merit and then send it out into the universe, dedicate it for the welfare of all beings. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.